the VCA Voice podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Marie Curl. Our goal with the VCA Voice is to showcase how VCA Animal Hospitals is taking care of the future of veterinary medicine. We'll bring our purpose to life through meaningful conversations about care, our culture, and the communities we serve. On today's episode, I'm happy to welcome Dr. Sharon Mix, who is the medical director at VCA Animal Medical Center of Omaha, and Dr. Sydney Stein, who's an epidemic intelligence service officer for the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention and is assigned to the Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services. Welcome, Dr. Mix and Dr. Stein.
Good afternoon.
If you don't mind, I'm going to go on a first name basis. So I'm going to start with you, Sharon. Tell me about your journey in veterinary medicine and about your current role.
My journey started when I was five, when I saw the family dog give birth to puppies. I knew then, just like everybody, when I was young, I wanted to do this career. I started working in animal hospitals 40 years ago this year. I went to Oklahoma State University. I got my DVM in 2009. I joined VCA in 2011. Out in Las Vegas, Nevada. I moved here to Omaha in 2013, where I became a part of VCA Animal Medical Center as their medical director.
Okay. So how's the medical director role been going?
Fantastic. I love growing a hospital and helping a team and making sure everything is running smoothly. I love this profession and I've been in it forever.
Sydney, I'm going to ask you the same question about your journey in veterinary medicine and your current role, because you've had a little bit of a non-traditional path.
I have. So similar to Dr. Mix, I started out at a very young age wanting to be a veterinarian, and I'd always dreamed I would go back to my home in Southeast Missouri and be an equine practitioner. But I had some experiences at the end of my undergraduate time where I questioned if clinical medicine was really the career path that I wanted. And fortunately, being at the University of Missouri, they have a dual degree program with a Master of Public Health where you can focus on veterinary public health. And I knew that I was very interested in infectious diseases, particularly zoonotic diseases that transmit between humans and animals. And I wanted to make an impact at a population level. I felt that would be a good place for my career to go. So I started my MPH, applied for veterinary school, knowing I wanted to do a career in public health. I took a one-year research position at the National Institutes of Health, working on a translational model of Zika virus, and I was hooked. So I ended up staying there for another 4 years to do a postdoctoral research fellowship. I actually ended up working on a human autopsy cohort of COVID patients.
Wow.
I worked on Ebola virus and a couple of different translational models for sepsis. And that just made me love public health even more. But during my MPH, I had read two books about epidemic intelligence service officers. One's called Beating Back the Devil, and the other one's Inside the Outbreaks. And I just was hooked on these disease detectives that were at sort of the front lines of identifying these emerging infectious diseases, many of which were zoonotic. And I thought, that's what I want to do. And so I applied to the program a little over a year ago and just started my two-year epidemiology fellowship with CDC. And I'm currently serving this at the Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services, which is a great place to be. I'm one of two veterinarians, so it's definitely a different, interesting work dynamic.
Oh, well, that's really just fascinating because most of the guests that I've had on the podcast have been really focused on clinical medicine. And I love your focus on public health. And actually, today's episode is really about that intersection between clinical practice and being a frontline veterinarian and then focusing on the public health aspect. Sharon, I'm going to jump back to you. Tell me a little bit about some of the challenges and rewards with being a primary care veterinarian.
Challenges are typically compliance and financial. It's been that way always, getting animal owners to understand the importance of what we're recommending. Sometimes people are limited in their financial ability to provide optimum care for their pets, but we do try to do the best we can with what they have. But the rewards, we don't have enough time in this podcast. I mean, being able to help animals come back from traumas or significant diseases to reunite them with their family members healthy is always the goal of a primary veterinarian. Also to prevent disease from puppy and kittenhood all the way up until geriatrics. Keeping them healthy or fixing disease or injury is my favorite part of being a primary veterinarian. I'm a clinical practitioner from day one. So every single day in this job, I love.
Sharon, you recently made a diagnosis for which all veterinarians are educated, but most veterinarians never make in their career. Certainly, I have not made this diagnosis in practicing for more than 30 years. You made a diagnosis of rabies. Can you share a little bit about that case and how it presented and when you first started to become concerned and then why you decided to submit for testing?
Sure. Monday morning, I was presented with an 8 to 10 week old male domestic short hair kitten, little short head fellow named Stanley. Mm. Stanley had been seen by another veterinarian for a bald spot on his head that was suspected to be ringworm and started on an oral medication. When I met Stanley that morning, his owner thought that the medication was making him sick. He was not eating as well. He was acting strangely. His temperature was a little low. Mm-hmm. So when I first examined Stanley, that was kind of a red herring because the thing that mom brought him in for was that he was acting strange and he had just been put on this medication. Most young kittens like that respond to a little bit of supportive care. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that can make little kitty cats not do well at that age. So at first thought, I offered him a little bit of food and he could eat on his own. I thought, okay, I will take this kitten, clean him up, give him a little supportive care, meaning get his body temperature up and see how he responds. The owner did show me a picture of his eyes. His pupils were different sizes. Hmm. But he did not have different sized pupils when I examined him.
Okay.
So at first, I was not thinking rabies. It's always on the possibility list of an animal that is young and unvaccinated. But honestly, I had three or four other possibilities that were much higher than rabies.
Sure.
So I started to give him that supportive care, heat him up, feed him. I sent him home with mom that night. And I said, okay, he was eating well, continue to feed him and bring him back tomorrow. I'll keep doing what I do during the day. The next day, he was not doing as well. He was low body temperature again. He was not as active. He was not eating on his own. So again, I still had rabies on my possibility list just because, but that wasn't my top thought with him.
Right.
I thought, oh, I need a little more aggressive support. I thought of infectious diseases. I thought of what's called fading kitten syndrome, where they just don't develop an immune system and they become low temperature, or bacterial diseases or viral diseases like feline leukemia. So I warmed him up again. He got a little brighter, but then the next morning he was not responding at all. And he passed away early on Wednesday morning. And at that point, when he passed away so quickly, I remembered a case I had 3 or 4 years ago of a little kitten that was brought to me as a stray. And she responded to therapy. She had upper respiratory infection. I adopted her out. She came back at about 12 weeks of age, very neurologic, hissing and spitting. And at that point, she was euthanized and sent in for rabies testing. So that kitten was in my head. So when this kitten passed away, I thought I better test it for rabies. I did not think it was highly probable.
Sure.
But this kitten was neurologic and I didn't want to miss diagnosing rabies.
And the prior case that you saw, was that kitten positive for rabies or did it end up being negative?
She was negative for rabies.
All right.
But she was extremely neurologic and aggressive and acting strange. And her, she just popped into my head when I was looking at this kitten. So I tested him just to be on the safe side to make sure that I wasn't going to miss this disease. I almost questioned my decision to test him because it's so unlikely.
It's very, very rare. And it is, it's really, you know, what's one of the remarkable things that you and I have talked about with this patient is that it's very difficult to keep a rare disease on your differential list when you're seeing lots of patients. What was your first reaction on learning that the kitten had tested positive for rabies? And what about your clients and staff? And how did you help them to deal with that process?
My first reaction was shock.
Right.
I really was surprised that this kitten actually came back positive. Then I called my hospital manager because I needed to find out which of my team members were exposed to this kitten. I had put this kitten in my isolation ward from the beginning.
Okay,
I didn't have it out in my regular population because it was a sick kitten.
Right.
I talked to Dr. Stein. I had my hospital manager contact the team members that were taking care of the kitten, and we started rabies prophylaxis. But my second emotion was grateful. I was really grateful that I tested the kitten. because the owners, when I talked to them, when I was submitting the kitten, I said, did this kitten scratch you? And she said, yes, they scratched and bit myself and my husband. She had scratches all up her arms. So I was really grateful that they could get the help that they needed.
Sydney, how unusual is a diagnosis of rabies in Omaha, Nebraska? And when was the last time that happened in that area?
So rabies diagnosis in bats is not uncommon in Omaha. We usually have between 6 to 10 bats a year, and people that either wake up with a bat in the room or have handled the bat trying to get it out of the house. And that's not uncommon. But for a domestic animal like a cat or a dog, that's extremely uncommon. And we actually haven't had a positive rabies diagnosis in either of those species within 45 miles in Omaha in over 20 years.
Wow.
So this was also not on our radar that this kitten would in fact be positive for rabies.
And can you tell me a little bit more about rabies in the United States? I'm assuming that a number of people listening may not know. And what are the wild animal reservoirs that carry rabies in different geographies? And is it the same infection in all species?
Sure. So rabies is a very ancient disease. It's been present in bats worldwide for thousands of years. But in the United States, at least in terrestrial animals, most of the infections in our wildlife happened much more recently from infected dogs that came over with European settlers. And so over time, being exposed to those dogs, they infected other animals like foxes, skunks, and raccoons. And they were very susceptible, being mammals as well, to the virus. And they had very large outbreaks or epizootics within those species. And then continued sustained transmission of the virus actually allowed for it to become adapted to those species and what we call variants now. So with very widespread efforts by veterinarians like Dr. Mix and yourself, in the 20th century, we were able to eliminate canine rabies in the United States, but we do still have bat variants and our terrestrial wildlife carrying variants. So along the entire East Coast, you mainly are dealing with a raccoon variant, and that goes from Maine to Florida and then over to the Appalachian Mountains. And then we have skunks in the central part of the United States. There's a northern and a southern variant, and then a population over in California, and then foxes around the country. So Texas has a problem in gray fox, Arizona has a problem in foxes, and even Arctic foxes in Alaska have rabies. And then finally, down in Puerto Rico, canine variants spilled over into mongoose. And so mongoose actually are the reservoir for rabies on the island. It's all rabies infections, but again, host adapted and able to spread quite readily within those species.
So upon receiving the diagnosis, further testing was done to identify the variant for this kitten. And is that step always done when rabies is diagnosed, or was that unusual in this case?
It is unusual. So prior to Stanley the kitten, we would only request that our partners at Nebraska Veterinary Diagnostic Center to do immediate sequencing of rabies viruses if we had a dog or a raccoon test positive, because we do not have canine or raccoon variants in Nebraska. We have skunk and bat.
Mm-hmm.
But given how long it had been since we had a domestic animal in Omaha, my superior requested that sequencing to be done, thinking that it was going to come back as a bat variant. And this is sort of an important teaching moment, because many people think having their pets only be indoors, they don't need to be rabies vaccinated. But in fact, most of the time when you're seeing in our part of the country a cat that is rabies positive, it's because it's been exposed to a bat that was positive. So he requested the sequencing, and when it came back as raccoon variant, we were shocked and sort of set off these alarm bells because we don't have this variant here.
So what would be the problem if all of a sudden the raccoon variant was in the Omaha area?
Initially, we only found raccoon variant in Florida in the late 1940s, and it was spreading locally, but it was contained. Unfortunately, in 1977, there was an introduction of raccoons into West Virginia for hunting, and at least one of those raccoons happened to be incubating rabies virus. And because the Mid-Atlantic region and its raccoons were completely naive and they had really high raccoon densities, it resulted in one of the most significant wildlife outbreaks in North America. And it then proceeded to spread in other wildlife species and had a lot of crossover exposures with domestic animals and livestock as it spread up and down the coast. and also crossed over into Canada. And so there have been massive amounts of efforts to try and prevent this from spreading, because raccoons, with them being so close to human activity mm-hmm. and their sort of normal territories of urban and suburban areas, they pose a lot of risk for not only exposing people, but their pets, and then people through their pets, if they don't realize the animal's been exposed and infected. So just to give you some context, before raccoon variant was detected in New York, there were less than 100 people a year that needed post-exposure prophylaxis, mm-hmm. like Dr. Mix and her team got. But in the 5 years after raccoon variant showed up, 10,000 people needed post-exposure prophylaxis. So this is a much greater risk of exposure to humans with this variant versus the bat and the skunk that we have currently in Nebraska.
Sharon, how did you partner with your local and regional public health and state animal health groups following the diagnosis?
I provided them with the contact information for the owners to get a hold of them. I provided them with the information of the veterinarian that treated Stanley initially so they could contact their team to inform them of the positive diagnosis. And then they took it from there.
Sydney, how important is it to identify people that are exposed before they show signs of rabies, and how much time elapses after exposure before they would potentially start to develop signs?
It's extremely important that anyone who knows or think they might have come into contact with a rabid animal be seen by a medical provider as soon as possible. And also that provider can work with the local public health authority to determine what the extent of the exposure, if any, was, and if post-exposure prophylaxis or PEP is necessary. The reason for this is because once people become symptomatic with rabies, it is almost 100% fatal. But the good news is that timely PEP administration is nearly 100% effective at preventing clinical rabies in humans. And so that is fantastic. If you don't receive treatment, we have very few people in the United States every year, typically 1 to 3 that are diagnosed with rabies and pass away, unfortunately. But typically the incubation period is a couple weeks to several months. So we would recommend that people be treated as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. Now, in the event that the animal is available for testing, we can test the animal to determine if it has rabies. So the one kitten that Dr. Mix remembered did not have rabies. So that would be able to save those individuals from needing the post-exposure prophylaxis. In Nebraska, I think we have a great system because the state will actually pay for animal testing in most cases where an animal has exposed a human. By doing that, one, it sort of lifts this financial burden for not receiving a diagnosis when there's an inkling that, you know, I doubt this is rabies, but I would like to rule it out. And it's a good thing to do that. We want to keep people from getting post-exposure prophylaxis when they don't need it because it's extremely expensive. It can be upwards of $5,000 per person. And sometimes insurance doesn't cover that. Mm-hmm. But in the cases where many people are exposed to a single animal and that animal happens to have rabies, we really want those people treated.
Right.
Specifically, if someone is exposed above the shoulders or particularly on the face, if they were to be bitten, we do recommend sometimes that they go ahead and start their PEP before testing results are available, just because it's a shorter distance for the virus to have to travel. But usually we can wait for that testing result before people need to proceed with getting their exposure prophylaxis.
And just to make sure that people understand, when you refer to PEP, that's post-exposure prophylaxis, right?
Yes.
So what's involved in the post-exposure prophylaxis? Is that just a one injection, or is that a series of injections? How does that work?
It's a series of injections. So traditional post-exposure prophylaxis for rabies is a combination of both rabies immune globulin and vaccine. So if an exposed person has never received a rabies vaccine before, they would receive that immune globulin injected at the site of exposure and nearby to bind up any virus that would be in the wound because they don't have their own antibodies yet. And then they would receive 4 injections of rabies vaccine over 14 days. And if a person was immune compromised, we would add a 5th injection at 1 month after exposure. But if someone's been previously vaccinated, like typically our veterinary staff are, they when exposed to a rabid animal just receive two doses of vaccine 3 days apart.
You mentioned that veterinarians are often vaccinated for rabies. Who should be vaccinated for rabies in a veterinary hospital? And are there any travel recommendations for rabies vaccination?
There are. So becoming vaccinated against rabies before an exposure is what we would call pre-exposure prophylaxis. And we recommend that for people who are likely to be exposed to animals. So veterinarians, laboratory workers, anybody who's handling animals, but also for travelers that are going to certain areas of the world that have very high risk of rabies due to feral dog populations. It's actually uncommon in the US that we don't have dog rabies because we've eliminated it, but it's very prevalent in some parts of the world and getting treatment can be difficult if you were to be exposed there. And for that pre-exposure prophylaxis, it's currently a two-dose regimen given 7 days apart. And then after people receive it, if they are going to be having ongoing risks of exposures for more than 3 years, they should have a titer or their blood antibody levels checked. And then if they've mounted an appropriate immune response, they're good. If not, they should receive a third vaccination.
Sharon, I'm going to ask you now, as a primary care veterinarian, there may be some pet owners who are listening to this podcast. Explain why it's important to keep all pets current on rabies vaccination as recommended by their veterinarian.
Well, this all ties back to Stanley and the raccoon variant, because there is a raccoon variant on the East Coast. We're talking about vaccination nationwide. So people do travel. One, we're a very traveling society now with air and automobile, not like back 100 years ago when people stayed put. But to keep these diseases from reemerging, that's why we do vaccination. We vaccinate our pets because this is a public health issue. This is a zoonotic disease. It is a fatal disease, and it has not been 100% eliminated in the wildlife population in the United States. And especially with raccoon variant rabies, like Dr. Stein mentioned, raccoons interact with dogs and people much more readily than, say, foxes and the other carriers of rabies. So to keep these diseases from reemerging, we need to be diligent and make sure that our animals are vaccinated so we limit the potential infection and transmission of these diseases. And bats do get in the house because there's multiple stories of people finding bats in their home. So as much as people don't think that exposure is probable, it is possible because Dr. Stein tests a lot of animals that are suspected of rabies.
So, Sydney, when this was diagnosed as the raccoon variant, especially as an epidemic intelligence officer, that probably was really interesting. So what happened in the regional community?
I was actually on personal leave in Maryland for a friend from veterinary school's wedding. I was her maid of honor. And we were getting our nails done, and I received a text message from my boss saying, that kitten who tested positive for rabies last week, the sequencing just came back, and it is raccoon variant, and CDC confirmed that initial result last night. And we are having a meeting with both CDC and USDA in an hour. Can you join? And so this was a Saturday.
Were your nails dry?
Not quite, but it's okay. Okay. I got my AirPods in and I was able to listen to the call. But it's a very serious matter. That translocation event in the 70s has wreaked havoc on the East Coast. And Congress has appropriated over $500 million for USDA to implement rabies wildlife management. Most of that is through dropping what's called oral rabies vaccine. There are these little sachets that are coated sort of in a fish meal coating to attract raccoons and other wildlife and vaccinates them when they eat it. And this has been successful so far at keeping raccoon variant east of Appalachian Mountains, which sort of serves as a natural barrier. But in the Midwest, no such barriers exist. Rivers are not really an effective barrier at keeping this from spreading. And so our colleagues at CDC did some very quick modeling based upon what actually happened a couple decades ago. And if we had not responded, and it was in fact in raccoons, it was estimated that within 5 years, it would have spread to five other Midwestern states near us, somewhere between 2 and 12,000 additional people were going to need post-exposure prophylaxis due to increased exposures. And it was potentially going to cost $93 million in the PEP administration.
Wow.
And that's a heavy burden for people given how expensive this is. And so we spoke with our colleagues. Because the kitten was so young, it was a stray. We didn't know where it had come from. There was no way to definitively prove at the time that the kitten had been brought from an area that is endemic for this variant. And so we had to proceed as if either there were other kittens and a mother cat running around with raccoon variant, potentially exposing wildlife, because Omaha has a very healthy and thriving raccoon population.
Yep.
Or we had to assume that somehow a raccoon with raccoon variant was in Omaha and had infected this kitten, and we were very lucky to find it. Thus far, we have tested over 300 animals, mostly found dead roadkill that the Humane Society Animal Control picks up on a regular basis. We have not found any additional cases of raccoon variant. And so we are hoping that however this kitten got to Omaha, that we have appropriately mitigated with our colleagues from USDA that flew over a dozen wildlife biologists to Omaha and did a trap vaccinate release campaign. And also we distributed 18,000 oral rabies vaccine baits around the Omaha area. We are hoping, you know, that either we got very lucky and when we caught the index case truly, or that our mitigation efforts have succeeded in not allowing this to gain a foothold in our wildlife population. But we are continuing to do surveillance for several more months just to make sure, because rabies can have quite a long incubation period compared to other infectious diseases. So it's looking very promising right now, given our current surveillance, not finding any additional cases.
No, that's wonderful news. And honestly, what scares me the most about this is to have an undiagnosed exposure of people that would die from rabies, because there just really is no treatment once you show clinical signs. So that's the most frightening part of this. So I really appreciate you providing that explanation. And in my book, you're both heroes. Dr. Mix, for remembering to think about a rare and unusual disease in this presentation. And Dr. Stein, for leading and working with your team and jumping into public health and as a veterinarian. So thank you both so much. I really appreciate your time. I wanted to make sure that we shared this story because it highlights the importance of what veterinarians do every day to help to protect human health. So thank you both so much for your time, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening in. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider subscribing. Don't forget to leave a review to let us know your thoughts and share the episode with friends. Follow VCA Animal Hospitals on social media at LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. For more inspiring stories, visit our website at vcavoice.com.